7 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Marvel Monday episode, and we'll be talking about three of the titles that came out last Wednesday, October 10th. And I'm also going to play for you an interview I did with the writer of The Immortal Hulk. It's Al Ewing. I got a chance to sit down and talk to him at New York Comic Con, and it was great to meet Al and talk about the book. Immortal Hulk is selling like hotcakes. That's kind of the impression I got from talking to Al and the conversation we had after I stopped recording. It really seems like everybody who's reading it is loving it. I don't want to say it's a new take on the Hulk, because it's incorporating a lot of ideas that have been behind the scenes or ideas that were right there in the beginning when Stan Lee and Jack Kirby created the Hulk, you know, man or monster. And it's been a really excellent title since Al's taken over, and the artwork by Joe Bennett is second to none as well. So let me start off by talking about The Immortal Hulk number 7, written by the aforementioned Al Ewing, pencils by Joe Bennett, inks by Rhee Jose, colors by Paul Mounts, and we have letters by Corey Petit, and of course Alex Ross has been doing the covers. So we saw at the end of issue 6, kind of a cliffhanger, the Avengers had tracked the Hulk down. They realized that he was alive, and they need to bring him in, basically. And so this issue is sort of a knockdown, drag-out fight with the Avengers. And what the Avengers come to realize is this is not a version of the Hulk that they've ever really encountered before. This one's a little bit more aggressive, I guess you'd say. I mean, even the Berserker Hulk or the Savage Hulk from the past, he always wanted to be sort of left alone, right? That was his thing. Like, he would fight because he didn't want to be bothered and he wanted to be left alone. This Hulk doesn't necessarily seem to feel that way. This Hulk seems to have more of an antagonistic streak in him. And we especially see that when he almost plays mind games with She-Hulk. And ultimately, the Avengers have to go a little farther than they thought they would in order to bring this Hulk down. And what we learn also, which is a really interesting tidbit, is that the Hulk really is triggered by absence of daylight, right? Like absence of UV rays. Because when they finally take him out, they get these UV lamps to like shine on the Hulk to keep him from like regenerating, right? So it's a whole new ball game here. It's an interesting take. What Al Ewing's doing, he really is playing to that word immortal. You know, the Hulk is unkillable at this point, just a complete machine of destruction. And you know, he's not the childlike Hulk who would lose his temper and become, you know, Savage Hulk, Berserker Hulk, whatever. It's not the intelligent Banner Hulk. I mean, this is really almost a malevolent Hulk at this point. And whether or not that has anything to do with what we've seen in the series so far and the Hulk being kind of inhabited or possessed by something, I guess that's yet to be determined. But I will say this as well. You know, obviously I'm not trying to spoil too much. The book hasn't even been out a week, so I want you all to get out there and read it for yourself. But the final page, and to see what's been done to the Hulk to kind of keep him under wraps, is pretty crazy and pretty brutal. So it was a whole lot of fun. This issue was a lot of fun. And wow, damage done for sure with what the Avengers had to do in order to take the Hulk down. So again, I'm going to play an interview I did with Al Ewing at the end of the podcast. So stay tuned for that. But he's been absolutely killing it on Immortal Hulk. So has the rest of the creative team. So the next book I'm going to talk about is Infinity Wars number 4. And for those that haven't been following along, basically what's happened is Gamora has killed Thanos, her father. She has taken control of all the Infinity Stones because there was a part of her that was trapped in the Soul Gem, supposedly. and her whole impetus of getting them back was she wanted that piece of herself that she got back. But when she got that back, it didn't seem to change her much. It didn't really seem like she was like, okay, now we can go back to a status quo. She seems to be almost drunk with power in a way. And the other thing that's interesting is that the soul stone needed to be rebalanced once her soul came out of it. So, I haven't read all the Infinity stories. You know, I've read the first three way back when: Infinity Gauntlet, Infinity War, I think the second one was, and then the Infinity Crusade. Since then, you know, I've dipped my toe in here or there, but I'm pretty far behind in the cosmic side of the Marvel Universe. Planning on getting caught up. I think I did read like the first issue of that Infinity miniseries way back when. I think it was in 2014, actually. It's been so long now. So I do want to get caught up with it, and I will eventually. But I say all that to just point out the fact that I maybe don't understand everything that's going on. I maybe don't understand all the pieces, but I'm still able to follow this and enjoy it. So it's a great job by the creative team. Now, that being said, I haven't enjoyed the last couple issues as much as the first two, and I'll explain that in a little bit here. But let me give the creative team first. It's written by writer Jerry Dugan. We've got art by Mike Diodato Jr., colors by Frank Martin, and letters by Corey Petit. Now, first a word about the art. When I've covered this in the past, I've talked about what a different style it is for Mike Diodato Jr., different sort of layouts and panels, different from anything I've ever seen him do before. So I find it to be very interesting. Like, I don't think that if I were to, you know, pull out an old Wonder Woman comic that he drew back in the 90s and put it next to this, that I would think it was the same artist. So it's an interesting art style that he's using. It's very detailed. The lines are very fine. I find myself liking the art for the most part. There are just a few times where, I don't know, I almost feel like he's trying to be a little too clever, with, you know, too cutting edge kind of thing. Sometimes it's okay to go a little more traditional. But again, for the most part, I'm really loving it. The colors have tended to be pretty muted throughout, which I find to be really interesting. You know, you would think that being a traditional superhero comic and cosmic, you'd really want to kind of lean into the more primary color palette. But for whatever reason, Frank Martin, the color artist, and probably in conjunction with Diodato and maybe even Dugan, I don't know, they're using a much more realistic color palette, I'll say. So what I'm not enjoying about the series is that, you know, Gamora, as I said, she hasn't kind of reverted back to who she was before. I can completely understand her wanting to get that part of her that's missing and being a driving force and not being able to think about anything else. But now that she's accomplished that, she seems, as I said, to be a little bit drunk with power. And she shows no signs of relinquishing the Infinity Gems. And in fact, seems to be almost controlled by them in a way. Like, she showed no signs of wanting to like rule the universe or be all powerful and be omnipotent. But now that she has the stone, she reunites with herself, and then she needs to, as I said, rebalance the soul gem. And that means putting a soul in it, I guess. Again, I'm not 100% sure. But what she chooses to do is kind of reminiscent of what Thanos did when he first got the Infinity Gauntlet and gained all the power, is she halves the population of the universe in half. But she doesn't do it the same way that her father did, by snapping his fingers, or, you know, same as Avengers 4 in the MCU, for that matter. So she doesn't do it by snapping her fingers and basically erasing from existence half the universe. No, instead, she folds the universe in half. So basically what happens is we get all these character mashups that are sharing a soul. So like Emma Frost and Wolverine, or Moon Knight and Spider-Man, or Steve Rogers and Doctor Strange. So you're getting all these warped versions with some Infinity Warped tie-ins. So I don't know if it's Marvel just, you know, wanting to play a little trick so they can sell some books of these mashed up characters. I don't know if the creative team thought it would be a lot of fun. To me, I don't really have any interest in reading about those mashed up characters. It doesn't really sound fun to me. It sounds just really gimmicky and silly, because I know in the end it doesn't matter. It's not going to last. These characters are going to be separated and back to their old selves. For that matter, it's not like the regular books are seeing these mashed up characters, right? So again, I almost feel like, what's the point? I am interested in kind of the overall driving story. Like, why does, what's driving Gamora? What's her motivation now that she's got her, the part of her soul back that she was missing? Why does she seem so intent on exploring those places in the universe that she's still unable to see into? You know, she's supposed to be omnipotent. She's supposed to be able to see everything. And obviously there's multiverse stuff going on. She's peeked into other alternate realities to see what's going on there, because, you know, what's happening for her and her having the power of the stones, it only affects this reality. So I don't know. I almost feel like, wasn't the Secret Wars series by Jonathan Hickman supposed to kind of clean up all the realities in the Marvel Universe, kind of like Crisis on Infinite Earths did way back in the day for DC? Even though, you know, as time went on, the cleanup seemed less and less effective. Almost feel like it's that way at Marvel right now too. But at the same time, it's like, well, you can erase and clean up and everything, but then writers are just going to come along and tell the stories they want to tell, and it's going to get all convoluted all over again. So it's still an interesting enough story that I'm going to finish it, but I feel like it's gotten overly complicated. It's gotten more complicated than it needed to. And again, I feel like that's not necessarily the writer, Jerry Dugan's fault. I feel like that part of it is probably editorially dictated. I feel like the main story, the story of Gamora with the stones and the story of betrayal and broken friendships, I feel like that's really the story that Jerry Dugan is trying to tell, and the rest of it's kind of been lumped on. So I don't know how successful this will be in the long run. So, but it's good that I'll be catching up on all this Infinity stuff over the next year or so, all the cosmic Marvel stuff, and it'll give me a better understanding and to find out if it's really time to stop these Infinity stories. You know, like I feel like they've gone even farther than DC with the Crisis word, right? All these different Infinity War and Infinity Siblings and Infinity. It may be time to give it all a rest. But I'm not going to say that yet, because as I said, I want to get caught up on it, and so I can speak intelligently about it and give it an honest review, rather than just saying, man, every time I turn around, there's another Infinity event. And I used to like Thanos as much as the next guy, but I mean, he's everywhere these days. He's got more titles than Wolverine. It's kind of ridiculous at this point, how unbelievably popular he's become. And then the other part of it is that Marvel had given Jim Starlin the reins on kind of controlling Thanos for a long time. And then they brought Donny Cates on, and Starlin was doing these graphic novels. And then Starlin left in not a good way, I'll say. You know, it wasn't a good parting for the relationship, because basically, the writer, Donny Cates, ended up doing something similar in the Thanos book to what Shooter was planning in the graphic novel. And Cates' stuff was going to come out first. And it's like, who's controlling this editorially, right? Once Jim Starlin finds out, he's like, hey, you just approved a story for the monthly that's almost exactly like the story I was planning on telling. Like, you know, what's the deal? And they didn't have a good answer for him. And so that was part of the falling out. And it's really too bad, because I don't know that anybody writes Thanos as well as Jim Starlin does. You know, he created the character, and he understands him in a way that a lot of other writers don't. It's not to say that other writers haven't handled him well. You know, it's not to say that Donny Cates is not handling him well. It's just, you know, Starlin's the originator of the character, and I feel like it should have been handled better. It shouldn't have gone down the way that it's gone down. And it's tougher for me to kind of accept the stories that other writers tell with Thanos, kind of attach more importance to them than the stories that Jim Starlin tells, you know, because again, he's the originator of the character. So I always lend more weight to those stories. So, all right, on to the last book I'm going to talk about that came out on October 10th. It's Domino from Gail Simone. We have art by David Baldione, colors by Jesus Obertov, and letters by Clayton Cowles. So I haven't talked about Domino since the first issue, I think, came out. And so the first arc just ended 6 issues, and then we got an annual that was a lot of little short stories, including one by Gail Simone. But a lot of it was kind of the origin of the posse, or the origin of the girl crew here that Domino's been hanging with. It's Domino and Diamondback and Outlaw that are kind of this mercenary group. So it's been a whole lot of fun. I don't know if there are too many other writers out there who are better at writing female character teams than Gail Simone. She has such a sense of family and sisterhood that she brings to these kind of stories. And it's been, it was very evident in the first arc, the 6-issue arc, just because that arc was so, and the story that was told was so ingrained in Domino's past and some painful things that she had to deal with when confronted with some people from her past and cast some doubt on her friendship and her trust in her friends. But her friends still, even though they knew Domino was doubting them, her friends still stood by her and they still had her back. And it was a really great, heartfelt story. And so Domino has been a really fun title. Great art by David Baldione, really slick, very primary colors by Jesus Obertov. So it's been a very beautiful book to look at. Baldione's art tends to be a little soft, a little curvy, which certainly suits the kind of female-centric part of the book. And we've gotten, as we often do in Gail Simone stories, some really interesting supporting characters like Henri, the riverboat. Yeah, they have a riverboat casino, and Henri is sort of the major domo, if you will. And then they've got a chef and a dog. And yeah, it's suitably quirky and suitably fun. And goes to show just what a great writer Gail Simone is, that she's able to take some lesser-known characters like Diamondback and Domino and make them really endearing and fun, really plays to their strengths. And again, the artwork has been second to none. So issue 7, I don't want to spoil, but issue 7 starts a new arc, and it apparently is going to be dealing with vampires. And based on the end of issue 7, it looks like Domino and her crew have gotten themselves in over their head once again through no fault of their own. And I can't wait to see where the story goes from here. We saw classic Marvel character make an appearance in this issue. Not a character that I see that often, but a character that has pretty long history in Marvel and is going to has a lot of relationships with other characters that I expect that we're going to see in the next few issues. So as I said, the book is really a lot of fun. I feel like Gail Simone, for me, is giving Domino the kind of the best voice that she's ever had. It's not like I've read everything Domino's ever been in from Marvel, but I don't remember ever having an insight into her kind of her character and her feelings and her self-awareness like we do here. And it's not to say that she has the healthiest relationship with herself. There's some self-loathing there. And she beats herself up pretty bad about things at times. So again, I think that Gail Simone is giving her a very unique and distinct personality, one that I haven't seen from Domino before. But it doesn't discount anything that's come before, because I think that kind of having this insight into the way Domino sees herself, the kind of the blustery, happy-go-lucky, braggart Domino before makes sense, right? It would be exactly the kind of defense mechanism or outer wall of false bravado that somebody with the doubts and lack of self-esteem and lack of self-confidence would project. So I don't know if Gail's aware of that, if she's doing that on purpose, or if this is just a story she wants to tell, and so she's kind of just going off on her own. I'll have to ask her that next time I see her. But it's a book that's doing really well, as far as I know. Like, I've heard nothing but good things about it. I hear a lot of people talking about it each time a new issue hits stands. So, you know, Gail has a pretty big fan base, so that's not surprising. But that being said, it's not like she's resting on her laurels or counting on that fan base to support a book that's not up to snuff. This is a very good comic. It's a lot of fun, and Gail does a good job of balancing the relationship aspects, the kind of the family feel of or sisterhood feel of this book, with some nonstop action and some greatly paced comics that are examining Domino and putting her showing her in a new light. So I would say if anyone was a fan of the Birds of Prey book back in the day, they should be picking this up. If anyone was a fan of Gail's Red Sonja run or Red Dynamite, you'll probably dig this as well. So and Domino fans, I'm sure, are digging this because she's got her own solo title, and it's doing really well, and it's a really quality story. So I hope you all are checking it out. All right, well, I think that's going to do it for this podcast. Obviously, I'm going to play the Al Ewing interview for you now. But before I do that, I just want to thank everybody for joining. Please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, I guess it is now. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at LRM Online. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Quick reminder, last show I'm going to be doing this year is Comic-Con LA, the last weekend in October. So I think I'm just going to be there Saturday. So if you're going to be there and you want to meet up, be sure and let me know. I always like to meet listeners and take some pictures and hand out some free Comic Source lanyards. So once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
All right, this is Jace coming to you live once again from New York Comic Con. I'm here with comic creator Al Ewing. Al, thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem.
Really, really appreciate it. I always like to ask people the first time they come on about their history with comics, like and you being from the UK.
Yep.
American comics. Like, did you grow up reading American comics, or?
In Britain, I think, well, certainly when I was growing up, every kid read comics, but they were the British comics, things like the Beano, the Dandy. I read Buster, which was a sort of IPC version. They were a different company. And then I graduated onto 2000 AD, which was also owned by IPC. And a few of your listeners might recognize that as the home of Judge Dredd.
Yeah.
And of course, recently, I should pause here and mention that recently we lost Dredd's co-creator, Carlos Ascara, which is, of course, you know, we're all still kind of processing that, still dealing with it a little bit. It happened early this week, and I don't think any of us have had time to sort of stop and reflect.
Yeah, I mean, a legend.
A legend, yeah, absolutely. One of the greatest masters of the art, and unlike anyone else. But yeah, to get back to the question, there were also reprints of American superhero comics by, and this was Marvel, this was primarily Marvel. Mm-hmm. So like Marvel UK put out reprints of Secret Wars. And there was Transformers as well. A lot of people read Transformers. I didn't, I just read Secret Wars. But that had the advantage of, that opened, as I remember, with all of the heroes standing in a line and saying their names. Which, you know, reads a little clunky to an adult, but when you're a kid and you have no idea who any of these people are, it's amazingly useful. And Jim Shooter did understand that. Unfortunately, the reprints of Secret Wars the first were immediately followed by Secret Wars 2. And, you know, I kept collecting that comic to the end, so I ended up with an extremely screwed up view of the Marvel Universe. And people, you know, that might be some sort of clue to, like, the weird places I've gone in my career at Marvel. But yeah, that would have been my introduction. And then, you know, American comics, actual American comics from America, became a little easier to get hold of. You could actually buy them in certain newsagents. So I started reading, like, the Walt Simonson Thor run, some Iron Man at the time. It was good stuff. It was like, there was a lot of really good stuff coming out at that moment. And you know, DC as well. This was the mid-80s. They were doing some, you know, Watchmen was coming out. They were doing some amazing things themselves. So it really felt like a kind of good time to be getting into comics.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, anyway.
All right, so from Secret Wars now to the Immortal Hulk.
Yes.
I wonder if you could tell our listeners a little about the overall feel and your thoughts. Like, what did you want the book to be when you finally got a chance to work on Hulk solo?
I mean, I think basically for a while, and I mean, I'd been pushing for this, editorial were pushing for this, we were all in the same direction of one mind, that we wanted like a tonal shift. Basically around January of last year, when we were doing like No Surrender, there was some talk about how to resurrect the Hulk, because like, we needed a big thing in No Surrender, and that was gonna be our big thing. It was time for the Hulk to come back, the Banner Hulk. And yeah, basically what, I had this idea like that maybe the Hulk wasn't resurrected by something, because he'd been resurrected a couple of times, right? Maybe he just came back. Maybe that was just what he was.
Right.
And I was sort of pitching this idea and pushing this idea and really kind of pushing it in the writer's room for No Surrender, and sort of, and I ended up kind of bagsying, calling dibs, I guess you call it over here. I kind of called dibs on all like the Hulk bits, to kind of like, because I was like, no, this is it, this is the thing. And like, I was thinking, yeah, like, let's make it a horror beat. And it's all like, yes, we like this, making a horror beat. But I didn't know at the time that I was going to be writing the solo book. I think an editorial were like, yeah, well, let's get a whole bunch of people together to pitch for this Hulk horror book. And, you know, I was one of them. And they were like, look, you've, and Tom was like, look, you've been pushing for this. Take a shot at it. And I ended up getting the book. And, you know, and here we are. But it's very much going into issue one. It's like everybody was on the same page. Everybody was just like, boom, you know, we're doing this. We're committed to this. And it meant we could really just kind of put something out that was 100%, you know, sort of impactful. It had that impact. It landed with that impact.
Yeah, it really has. And what I love, you're going all the way back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Cover of Hulk 1. That question, man or monster, right?
It's,
and that's bringing the horror vibe in. Now, are you going to answer that question, or do you think that question can be answered?
I think it's almost up to the individual reader to answer that question. You know, about the Hulk, about all the other characters in the book, about themselves. It's like, you know, that's kind of the theme of it, is like the ways in which, you know, we all have our kind of Hulks. We all have our, the parts of ourselves that we can't admit to, that we can't kind of look in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of very, I think towards the end, you know, yeah, we might end up answering that question towards the end, or providing an answer. But it's like, the thing with this is like, you know, you have an idea of your theme going in, and then there's the theme that you know going in, and then once you wrap it up, you look back and you see it was also about this. And I've found that every story I've ever done, I've gone in thinking it's about this. I look back at the end and it's like, it was also about this. And that's going to be true of the Hulk as well.
Yeah, and that's awesome, just layering the stories. Now, when I read Immortal Hulk, I really get a nostalgic feel for the old Bill Bixby Hulk TV show that I grew up with. Yep. We even have a reporter named McGee.
Yeah.
And what I loved about the show, and I love these kind of stories, it's about, Bruce was out there on his own, kind of in the back roads of America, helping out when he could. So, that's obviously got to be something you're drawing from, right?
There was definitely an influence. Now, I didn't watch that much of the TV show. I sort of, I didn't watch that much of it. I kind of I saw the TV specials. Mm-hmm. I saw the occasional one-off episode. You know, it's repeated all the time.
Right.
But I'm not a huge fan of it. And there are some huge fans out there who've been really gratified that I've sort of done these little nods and Easter eggs, which kind of, they're little nods, they're little Easter eggs. I always like it when, you look on the old Marvel wikis and it's you see all the alternate versions listed. And I always get a kick out of taking characters that exist in other media and in, or other dimensions and making regular Marvel Universe versions of them. That's fun for me. I do that, and it's a nice little Easter egg, and it's not too big of a thing that people feel they have to have seen the TV show. But yeah, there was a slight influence. I knew I wanted to start it with Bruce Banner isolated on the run or wandering the earth. Basically, for the first five issues, I wanted him cut off from his friends, willfully so, he means to be. And so yeah, definitely there's a kind of a thing for TV show. I'm sorry, PJ. Definitely there's a thing of the TV show in there.
And just based on our quick chat here with how many fans are coming up and their reaction,
yeah.
It seems like everybody's digging it, right?
This is what I'm hearing. I'm hearing from comic shops that, they can't keep it in stock. Fans are really, I've heard maybe 20 times this weekend that people who were not previously Hulk people are now digging it. So the word of mouth is getting out there. People are really like it. I couldn't be happier with that. I know the rest of the team is really happy with the response. We're really gratified that people are liking it so much. And, I'm really hoping that means we're going to get a long run, and once it's all over, we'll have something people remember. And, I think that'll be... That would be very nice to be to be up there with Greg Pak and Peter David and Bill Mantlo and all of the really great Hulk writers.
Yeah, the classic runs. I do have to say,
all the way back to Stan.
Yeah, and I do have to say, this has that feel. This has that classic feel because you are bringing in little Easter eggs with the TV show like you mentioned, but also going back to exploring that question, man or monster. So
yeah, that is partly what it's all about.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you so much for your time, Al.
Thank you.
Loving the book, and listeners, you jump on board this train because it's a runaway and it's a whole lot of fun. Loving the ride.
Thank you so much.